This is the regular city council meeting. It's Monday, October 12th, 7:00 PM.
Father, we thank you for this wonderful day that you've given us and the blessings that you have bestowed upon the city, and that you could be with us here tonight and guide us with your wisdom, that we make decisions that are good for the city and the citizens. And we pray this in your name. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, roll call. Both Gina and Angel have called in tonight. Angel's still in Arizona, and Gina is on her way back from the west side. We will need a vote for excuse for them both. We'll do them one at a time.
Make a motion for Angel?
Yes. All in favor of excusing Angel?
Aye.
Any opposed? So pass. Okay, for Gina?
Make a motion to excuse Gina.
Second. First and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? So pass. This is a time for citizen input. Anybody that has got anything that they'd like to discuss with the council at this time, allow up to 5 minutes for this point. Seeing nobody, we'll go on to approval of the agenda. Do I have a motion to approve the agenda tonight?
Make that motion.
Second.
First and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? So carry. Consent agenda. Motion for the consent agenda?
Motion.
Second.
First and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, so pass. Okay, 4.1, overhead utility lines. Paul Kamel from Avista.
Good evening, Mayor Pro Tem and council members and staff. Paul Kimmel's my name. I am a business and public affairs manager with Avista. I'm based in Pullman, Washington. Do you need a street address or anything? Okay, good. Thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. I did provide you packets of information, and before I talk a little bit about our franchise relationship as well as some of our joint use arrangements, I wanted to just alert you, and I shared with Travis earlier about a program we're doing with streetlights and converting all of our streetlights to LED technology. It's a program that we've worked really closely with the Transportation Improvement Board over the past year to create a program where we actually can reduce, surprise, reduce your streetlight rates based on LED technology. So over the course of the next 5 years, Avista will be changing out over 30,000 streetlights to LED technology. So, and Othello happens to be one of those communities. So I'll keep you updated as far as when you fall on that schedule. But again, it's pretty good stuff, and we're excited to be a part of a program like that. So with that, I wanted to just share a little bit about the nature of franchise agreements, our relationship with you as well, and then Steve Schulte, our joint use administrator, is going to come up and share a little bit more about that. And you have some of these slides in your packet as well. Just a little brief introduction about our company, Avista franchise overview, joint use overview as well, and how we go forward and make sense of all this. First of all, thank you. Thank you for the relationship we have with you as well as the ability to provide you electric service in the community. It's important for us as well as it is for you, and I think you'll see that in my slides here tonight. Avista was incorporated 126 years ago under the name Washington Water Power. We are a Washington-based Spokane company. founded on the banks of the Spokane River. Naturally, our primary business is electric and natural gas energy service. We have about 1,600 employees in four western states and over 350 electric and about the same in natural gas. Our territory consists of both Washington, northern Idaho, eastern Washington, parts of Oregon. As well, we just acquired a company up in Juneau, Alaska. Don't ask me why, but it was an interesting opportunity for us. It was a family-owned business, and actually they really liked the Vista's culture as well. So we acquired that last year, Alaska Energy and Resources Company. It serves both the city of Juneau and the borough of Juneau. It's a hydro-based utility, so we have a lot of familiarity with that as well. But as you can see, the terrain is a little different than central Washington. And these boxes here are transmission structures that either were damaged or destroyed by some avalanches a few years ago. This is about 50 feet high. That's all snow up to the top of that transmission line. So incredible conditions that they work with up there. Nothing like Othello or Spokane or a lot of other places, but I thought you might appreciate some of the creative ingenuity that we have to employ out there. On the right here is an avalanche protection structure above the transmission tower. So those are about a $3 million per structure investment. So lots of, and really cool equipment, but no thanks. I'm not interested up there, but amazing stuff. We are still about a 50% hydro-based utility. The rest is a mix of natural gas, some coal. We own a portion of Colstrip, Montana, as well, and a little bit of biomass, and one wind project over in eastern Washington, Palouse Wind, just north of Colfax. Our largest hydro facility is Knox and Rapids on the Clark Fork River in Montana. And we have a system of hydro projects along the Spokane River, as well as another one on the Clark Fork. Our largest natural gas generator is in Boardman, Oregon. You've probably driven by that outside the Port of Morrow. And then again, here's Colstrip, Montana. So we have an interest in that facility along with four other utilities. And there's our Palouse Wind project. This was commissioned in December of 2013. It's 105 megawatts. Actually a very productive wind resource for us as well. Here's our woody biomass plant up at Kettle Falls. And recently, and I'll share just briefly a little bit about the renewable portfolio standards that we're required to comply with here in Washington State. We were successful in getting the legislation changed to allow us to recognize woody biomass as a renewable resource and hence qualify as a resource under that law. This is not uncommon to all of us around here, especially with Grant County and Adams County and some of the PUDs or Big Bend. Some of our rates in the Northwest are the lowest in the country. Avista, Idaho and Avista, Washington are some of the lowest of investor-owned utilities anywhere in the country. Of course, Hawaii and Alaska are some of the highest rates. The U.S. average is about $136 per 1,000 kilowatts. So. And again, because of our large hydro footprint, we have a pretty small carbon footprint as well, which is good, especially going forward with all the challenges we have around carbon emissions and clean coal and so forth. How we spend your rate dollars, it's about 60% on the resource as well as how we generate it, and then the 40% is how we distribute it and get it to you, your homes and businesses. But it's a balancing act for us around three big circles and spheres of influence: the cost, the reliability, and environment. So we continue to have to balance that, and your interests may not always be equally balanced in those three spheres, so it's a challenge for us going forward as a utility. And again, as I mentioned earlier, renewable portfolio standards are required in Washington, and by 2020, we're to have 15% of our generation as a qualifying resource. So we don't get to count our legacy hydro, only our upgrades to hydro. So we've purchased the wind project, all the generation off that as well, and then since we've been able to amend the law to allow woody biomass, will be in full compliance by 2020 with that 15% renewable standard. So that's a good thing. So I want to talk just briefly about franchise agreements. These are really powerful tools for both you and the utility to manage people in your public right-of-way, like Avista. And the franchise outlines those rules, rights, and fees for our property in your right-of-way. We operate under a franchise agreement with you that's dated 2006. It's your ordinance number 1223. By definition, franchise agreements allow private companies like Avista to provide services to your community, and that's the whole benefit and intent of that. And again, you derive your power through state law, and then again, you set the local control and the parameters around which we can operate in that. It's pretty clear. So you set those conditions. But again, franchises provide these really important areas, certainty in the fact that you know who you're dealing with and we know who we're dealing with, City Hall at the utility. Stability, it gives us a relationship, long-term relationship. Longevity, this one is a 25-year agreement, which is pretty standard for us as we work with communities, whether it's gas or electricity. And again, it's also financially beneficial for you if you're going out for bonding. Some of the infrastructure needs, I mean, you need that sort of stability in your bonding and indebtedness. And then it's just good business practice for both us as a private company as well as for the public. So I'm going to hand this over right now to Steve. And Steve's going to talk about joint use a little bit, because I certainly am not the expert in that. So I will hand it over to you. So that's forward.
Good evening, Council. I'd like to say thanks, just like Paul did, for the opportunity to speak. I'd like to go over a few points about what joint use is and how we manage that at Avista Utilities. Again, my name is Steve Schulte. I'm a joint use inspector for Avista, based out of Spokane, Washington. And I cover from Spokane east to Othello, or west to Othello, and then as far down as Grangeville, Idaho. So pretty big area, a lot of forest to look at. So the objectives of joint use are to help ensure worker safety on all Avista facilities, the safety of the general public, adherence to Avista standards and any applicable local, state, and federal safety codes, and to provide non-discriminatory access to our facilities, which is really important. We level the playing field and we allow everybody equal access to our facilities to provide service to their customers. Joint use is a sharing of poles between the pole owner and the renter, and we do that through agreements. Typically, we share poles with a local telephone company. Back when the utilities were started, there was an equal amount of poles between the two utilities, so phone had a certain amount, if Washington Water Power had a certain amount. And then as the years went on, Avista started owning more poles, and then we started a joint use agreement. So we use their facilities, they use our facilities. Pole attachments are regulated by the federal statute, provide non-pole owning cable and telecommunication service providers with access to utilities distribution poles, conduits, and rights of way. About the only place we rent conduit is in downtown Spokane. Other places, people put in their own conduits. The Cable Act of 1934, we were thinking about that all the way back then. Joint use purposes were simple: reduce the cost to consumers, share the high cost of infrastructure fairly and equitably, minimize the visual impact of two separate pole networks, and minimize roadway hazards. Common joint use sharing, cost sharing methods are shared burden of ownership with each party owning a similar amount of poles. That's the parity that I was talking about earlier. Joint ownership of each pole is called joint use, and other methods used in some regions. Joint use jurisdiction, the Federal Communications Commission sets guidelines, rules, and rate formulas for joint use granted by Congress. They defer to state utility commissions for administrators of joint use and settlement of disagreements. So in the state of Washington, they passed a law that the state of Washington would like to regulate that instead of the FCC. So that's, we have the Washington State Utilities Commission that regulates joint use. 20 states elected to administer their own, including Washington, Idaho, Oregon, California. In 1978, the Second Pole Attachment Act was passed. investor-owned electric and telephone utilities, first subjected to the FCC pole attachment regulation, provided for a lower subsidized pole attachment rate for cable TV, and that was in an effort to push cable TV out to more places that probably couldn't afford to have it if the rates were too high. Government-owned utilities cooperatives, REAs like Inland Power and Light, Big Bend Electric, and railroads were exempt from that order. Policy goal is to encourage new market entrance of cable TV and enter into the video business, like I mentioned. And it did not address the protection of utility systems. In 1996, they passed another Telecommunications Act. It was intended to promote competition and duplication in telecommunication and cable markets, so other entrants could make their way into those communities. Access rights were expanded to include telecommunication providers and establish a rate methodology. Access to utility poles were made mandatory, so utilities could not deny access to utility infrastructure. A utility can show that capacity, safety, or reliability would be compromised based on engineering requirements. It was the only cause for denial of access. And then in 2010, Congress passed the National Broadband Plan. There was the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, and it directed the FCC to develop a national broadband plan, and that was to push broadband out to the far reaches of the country. The plan identified access to poles as a significant factor in impacting broadband deployment. The objectives were to promote broadband, reduce barriers to broadband deployment, lower the cost of broadband deployment to all parties. In 2011, the FCC passed another pole attachment order, which increased the right of third-party attachers, which would be your telecommunication companies. Timelines established limits for utilities' response time to new requests, reduced rates to the telecom rate, or from the telecom rate to the low cable rate, so that would make it less expensive for companies to push out into more rural areas. And they allowed wireless access to the pole top. So that's actually one thing that the Utilities Commission in the state of Washington is looking at, is allowing pole top access for antennas. And that's to push more wireless and cell phone technology out into the farther areas. Use of contractors. Attachers may hire utility contractors for make-ready work. And make-ready work is work that the utility has to do to make their system ready for deployment of those facilities. So taller poles, more poles, stronger poles. ILECs, which are incumbent local exchange carriers, that's CenturyLink, Frontier, or regular telephone companies. They may request rights of telecommunication carriers, so that would give CenturyLink and those incumbent local exchange carriers the same rights as the telecoms and the cable TV companies to a lower rate. Also allow for dispute resolution. Attachers can sign and sue. They can basically sign the agreement and sue later. So it's that speed to market that the FCC was really pushing for. And pole access, it allows for boxing or bracketing of poles, which is running cables on either side of the pole. So this is a Vista joint use by the numbers. We have a little over 78 distinct joint use customers operating across our service territory in Washington and Idaho. That includes cable TV, telephone, internet, fiber, car dealerships, hospitals, city governments. It runs the gamut of attachers. Roughly one-third of all of Vista poles has at least one joint use attachment. So that's quite a large number of our poles. There's 250,000 poles in our network, so that's a lot of poles that people are attached to. And as an average, it's at least one cable. We manage around 132,500 pole contacts within our region between two people. So it's a little bit of driving time. We create and complete around $500,000 worth of requested make-ready work, pole replacements, taller poles, electric rearrangements, and that allows for new pole contacts and the resolution of existing code violations. And that work is paid for by the joint use companies themselves. Because as a utility, we're not allowed by our tariff to pass that cost along to the ratepayers. So if an attaching entity needs to tell our pole, we can't raise our rates to accommodate. We review 350 pole route applications annually and resolve code and compliance issues that are discovered. And we perform follow-up inspections on 10% of all the approved route applications that we approve. This is a pole attachment tracking sheet that I created when Corey, John, and Wade brought to our attention quite a few of the pole transfer issues that were lingering in the city of Othello. I sent that list out to all the joint use companies. There were 17 distinct locations that were identified with the help of our local servicemen and Ian Echols, our local manager. As of tonight, 16 of those were complete. One is pending, and the other one, Avista, still has to go back and pull the old pole and restore the ground. So the one that's pending, it's a rather complex situation. The new pole was set about 15 feet away from the old pole, so CenturyLink has quite a bit of work to get that spliced to that new location, which means taking down customers. I'll be working with them on that. But in the meantime, you know, driving around town, I did find four or five more locations that I will be sending out for low lines, drop wires, little small service wires that had been cut and hanging. So as we find them, we're fixing them. Back to Paul. And I just want to mention, in Othello, there are six attaching entities, CenturyLink, NoNet, Noel, Northland, Big Bend Health Corporation, and the school district. So just in Othello, there's, you know, six attaching companies, so that's, you know, a few people to let know that we are changing poles. And I did create a distribution list within our own company so that it'll make it easier for Ian when he does put a new pole in the ground, that he can just hit one button, send it to one email address, and then it sends a note to every single attaching company, whether they're on the pole or not, that there's a new pole and that they need to transfer to them. So hopefully we'll get that process a little more dialed in and those pole transfers will get done a little quicker. But at any time, you can shoot me an email if you see anything you don't like, and we'll get it taken care of. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. With that, I'm not sure if you have any questions for us. It's unfortunate that we had to come to this tonight to have this discussion. We try to pride ourselves on being good community members. We certainly want to help you grow in your prosperity in this community. I know we talked with Travis about, you know, you have some pretty lofty strategic goals to grow this community, and we will be there right alongside you for certain of that. But again, I think we're demonstrating a good faith to clean this up. Again, I apologize on behalf of Avista that we had to come to this point and work through some of these situations. And Ian Echols, our local manager, sends his regrets. He had a family outing scheduled already, but he would have been here. And you could have asked him really hard questions. With that, Mayor Pro Tem, thank you for the opportunity tonight.
Is there any further questions from any of the council?
We've got more to do on this particular item for tonight, right? I think you presented yourself very well. Thank you very much for addressing some of the issues that we discussed in that meeting. It's a step in the right direction.
Absolutely.
You guys all understand where we're at. We have a law on the books. We have to decide what we're going to do with that moving forward because it's been abused. So I appreciate your effort in educating us.
Good. Thank
and
you.
Helping us.
Yeah. And that will continue. You have our word.
Thank you. We'll go on to 4.2, presentation from NoNet for variance.
Good evening. I'm Chris Walker. I'm the telecommunications director with NoNet, and I come from Spokane, Washington. So when we conducted the workshop last month, after I left the meeting, I sat down and took some notes, trying to make sure I captured what the goals and objectives were from the city, as well as the team here in the audience, on what we want to do to accomplish your goals and objectives. And I summed it up into three areas. The first area, it was very clear that there was substantial concern with the conditions of the aerial infrastructure in town. Quite a photo presentation by Terry outlining all the challenges and issues, whether it was low clearance, safety violations, of course, the aesthetic issues and so forth. It didn't take long for Avista to do exactly what they promised that meeting, and that was lead a charge to ensure some of those items were being corrected. That spreadsheet that Steve showed on his spreadsheet came out very quickly. It outlined all the things that they saw in their first review that needed to be fixed. And as Steve reported, it looks like we had 100% or to the point participation. So when I reflect on the objectives from the meeting, it appears as if, and gratefully so, that we're on the right path to ensuring the aerial architecture in your city is starting to get repaired, cleaned up. I imagine that there's probably more work to do, but it sounds like Avista is committed to doing, or godfathering it, I should say, because really it's up to utilities such as ourselves to make sure that any violations we have, are in fact fixed. So, to my knowledge, nothing from no one's perspective is in violation. If and when that were to occur, we would immediately fix it. But I have yet to discover, nor has anyone on my team, nor has anyone from Avista determined there were additional discrepancies for our system. So that's the point number one from the discussion. The second one that I thought was important was the city's recognition that there could be some potential for some ordinance modification to better facilitate the needs of the city, but as well as the needs of the attacher or the aerial infrastructure installation company. And I know there's probably more thought around that the city needs to do and some more investigation needs to happen. But looking at the presentations that Avista just shared, we see a clear driver from the FCC to ensure that we have the ability, we as utility attachers, the ability to attach to aerial infrastructure. And the reason that is important is because there is a nationwide initiative to ensure affordable broadband telecommunication services in rural communities. And the way that happens is by partnering with agencies such as Avista and CenturyLink to attach to their poles. Going underground is substantially expensive. And so to do a greenfield underground build out to serve a customer typically is not affordable. And what I heard on multiple occasions from Wade was we need to bring broadband pricing down in our community. And having a vibrant set of ordinances that allow for utilities to attach, I think, is critical. I was down in Anaheim about 2 months ago for a fiber to the home coordination council meeting, and we spent about 2 days discussing various aspects of fiber to the home and fiber to the premise projects, and probably the good part of the second day was all around economic development, and what consumed the majority of that conversation were around aerial attachments and ensuring that the objectives of the FCC, which was one of the slides that Steve shared, were being met. And the reason that so much time was spent on that is because everybody within that council understands and recognizes that in order to bring affordable broadband to homes and to businesses really requires the use of the existing infrastructure versus recreating infrastructure from scratch. And then the third thing that I took away from that meeting really was specific to Noel and Noahnet, and that was our particular variance request. So between that meeting and now, I sent over to Travis every document he requested, which was coincidentally what we created. And it really encompasses three things. One was a financial analysis of the project. So I wanted to make sure that you guys saw that we weren't making these numbers up. There is a large disparity between underground construction and that for aerial. And we have a spreadsheet that was presented to the city that shows that. And then the second thing that we sent were the actual engineering prints that were developed for this project that we're building. And those prints, there's two sets. One was for the Avista poles, and one was for the Big Bend poles. And this is a process that we go through with every utility when we put in an application to attach their poles. And I don't know, Wade, if we have those available to quickly look at.
Show us which attachment it is.
Why don't we turn up the Avista one, since this is here to attach themselves?
That was a joke.
I guess I have to tell.
My two jokes.
So I won't bore you with these details. If you could go to the second page for me, I'd appreciate it. But essentially, we create a set of engineering drawings that outlines how it is we intend to construct facilities in the air, or even underground would be the same thing. And our engineers go out there and they examine, we call it staking, they examine every pole and make decisions based on their experience on what needs to happen at each pole. And there are multiple things that they take into consideration. But long and short of it, they take into consideration what the violations are, what the height of attachments need to be in order to ensure clearances. And then our engineer will create these drawings and put in, sorry, they're not coming up, but they put in field notes that essentially state, okay, here's our recommendations. This is what we're going to do to make sure that when we attach, we're going to be in compliance. And those can say multiple things. They may say, hey, we need Noel to move up 6 inches. We may need CenturyLink to move down 6 inches, or we may need to switch to the other side of the pole, or we may need to put people on arms and so forth. And so we put those recommendations in using our engineering staff. We send them over to Steve and his team, and they do the same thing. So we've got two sets of engineers from two different entities looking at the same set of poles. And they come back with their, counter recommendations or their conclusions based on the analysis that they did. And in many cases, they're identical, and in many cases, they differ. And it's simply because the power company has a is the final decision maker, of course, and so they're looking at it from everybody's benefit. They're looking at it for Noel's benefit, CenturyLink's benefit, their own benefit, making sure we're within violations. And then they respond with these call-outs to say, okay, NoMed, we agree with you. However, in this particular place, we want you to move 6 inches, not 2 inches, or what have you. But the goal is to make sure we're not violating any of the NASC requirements, and we're making all of our clearance issues. In this particular one, this is actually requiring an entire pole changeout. So we'll go from a 40-foot to a 45-foot pole. Everybody will be moved up, and the addition of a second line, or a third line, I should say, which would be NoNets, would eliminate any of those clearance issues, which you spoke to at the workshop. And so once this application process is iterated between us and Avista, eventually it gets approved. It's part of our permit to the city that we're going to perform the job in this manner. And then all these requirements have to get done. So we'll contact Noel. We'll say, hey, on pole 7, 10, and 12, we need you to do these three things. And Noel will either go out there and do it, or they'll say, no, Ned, you can go ahead and do that transfer or that move yourself. And we'll call CenturyLink, and CenturyLink, you've got to do, pole 1, 7, 6, and 2, and the same thing will happen. And we'll pay all the fees associated with all that move. And then once all that is done, including the pole replacement, which we talked about in this example, once that's completed, NoNet will come back, do their installation. Avista will sign off that we've met the requirements of the permit, and away we go.
When you say permit, that's permit with Avista?
Correct.
Okay. What about your permit with the city?
Same thing. I mean, the city gets these same types of drawings. We permit.
So when you do your application for a permit right of way, use in the permit right of way, I mean, you have a franchise agreement with Avista. Avista has the right to be there in the right of way.
Correct.
But you don't. So you have to file a right of way permit. And so are you doing these changes before the permit's authorized by the city?
The city, I'll let Terry speak to it rather than myself, but he wouldn't authorize a permit without us getting Avista sign off.
Okay.
So I'll let Terry speak for himself, but we wouldn't attach without a city approved permit. So.
Okay. And all these items that you're saying here, then they're discussed with staff, with city staff.
I would say the answer to that particular question pointed is no. We would do these changes in accordance with the Avista's rules, not the city's. I don't think the city has construction guidelines to dictate how we attach the poles.
No, but this all goes to the fact that you're looking for a variance to hang on a pole.
Correct.
To get away from the underground. So to satisfy the city's requirements, you know, we need, like I said before, we need some sort of assurance that you're going to do the things you say you're going to do. And this is the first time we've seen these, you know, notes and engineer drawings. So I just want to capture that and say that, you know, if you do the things you say you're going to do here, you know, that's, you're providing us with a reason to give you a variance.
Correct. And nor would any of us start on these modifications until we had the approved permit from the city. So we wouldn't do the work on our own and then have the city deny a permit. We'd make sure the city approved the permit first. And so we submit whether we're doing aerial or underground, and that's the same across the state. I mean, every city, we put in the same package. Every city's a little bit different, of course, but we put in the same permit application package with the construction drawings.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, so with that said, those are my 3 points. So I won't wrap it up. I think I'll open it up to questions or give Noel an opportunity to speak as well.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
Back to your financial, the rundown on the financials you gave to us. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how you come up with those numbers.
We are a public agency, and so we go out to competitive procurement for every job we do, and that is the awarded contractor gave us those rates.
You don't mention what contractor is on here. They're just a list of rates.
Uh-huh. It's Robson Brothers Contractors.
Okay. And here's the reason I'm curious. There's two things I'll make a point of. For the first one is, I'll do the easy one first. You have a permit listed on here. The city permit for $176. Our city permit is $40.
That's how much RBC charges us if they were going to actually do the application for the permit themselves. In this particular case, we will do the permit application ourselves just because of the sensitivity. But RBC would charge us $175 to put the permit paperwork together to then turn in. It's not how much you charge us.
Okay. Now, the next one. For a 2-inch directional bore, you have 74,200 listed here.
Mm-hmm.
We did, and that's for 1,000 feet for 3 blocks. We did 2.5 blocks here a little over a year ago for 19.6.
Mm-hmm. $19.60 a foot?
No, it was 19 for. The total job, and this was also including running pipe, running the line for the wire, running the wire. The complete job for that 2.5 blocks was $19,682.
Okay.
You guys are saying it's $74,200 just to drill a hole for 3 blocks. For half a block longer.
Right.
You'll come up with whatever that $15,000 difference.
Yeah, so directional drilling has multiple aspects to it. When you drill, there's a pound per square foot requirement of the drill that you're utilizing. And so the deeper you go, the harder the rock, the more expensive the job is going to be. And so our experience building out to the cell tower on the northwest side of town with the depth the city required for us to build out, which was typically about 10 feet deep, it was running us the rate you see on that sheet. I will agree with you that there are instances when a contractor would charge us, say, $18 a foot. In this particular situation, we're looking at the price you see in there of the 70, I think it was, a foot.
Yes, $70 a foot. Yeah.
Correct.
But here's the deal. I talked to our public works director, and he's saying the dirt up there is decent dirt.
Yeah, fair enough. And no. if it ends up not being cobble like we suspect and we're able to shallow up, then we might get a reduced rate out of our contractor. So I'm not going to argue I'm not going to argue the point you're trying to share is that it could be cheaper. It could be cheaper. It could.
Yeah. Okay.
It's still going to be substantial. When we're talking about $3 to do aerial compared to anywhere from $19 to $70 a foot, you're talking a lot of money. And the unfortunate part about a directional drill is we can't share that with any other utility. So it's just our costs.
for our fight. And here's one other point, too. Here, just a few months ago, we did a 36-inch hole down across 17. The entire job was less than $100,000, but 36-inch hole. You know, it just, we have a code in place, and I like that code. I like that code a lot. I think it's a good code. You know, and I'm seeing these really high numbers here, and they just, comparing them to what we've had done, I think they look really inflated.
Sure. Well, the only thing I can say is I can take your engineering specifications, I can compare against ours, and then come back with a, with an analysis on the cost differential. Just off the cuff, though, I can't quantify why your pricing is different than ours. Your construction methodology is completely different. I don't think you're directionally drilling a 36-inch hole. But maybe you are.
Well, that's just what was given to me, and I...
Understood.
You know, and as far as the lighting project, should be pretty much the same. Yeah. It's a 2-inch hole, it's a 2-inch hole. It's a 2-inch directional bore hole.
I understand your concern. I've built 1,600 miles of fiber in this state underground, and those numbers are consistent with what we see from every contract in the state.
And I actually have one other point that I want to make. You said that you were in 100% compliance with our codes here. And actually, you have 8,200 feet of wire that's out of code that's running in town.
How's that?
That's not compliant with our codes. It's above ground, it's not underground.
Fair enough. However, we did go through the permitting application process with your public works, and it was approved. So they didn't go without approval.
It was approved?
Absolutely.
Is that right, sir?
Some of it may have been existing prior to that building being so. There are a lot of factors. That number, I think, might just reflect the above ground versus the underground aspect. So if it were removed or replaced, it would either become a new code.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you, but we were here 3 years ago. I stood in front of the city council and went through the entire project with you. It was part of the American Recovery Reinvestment Act. And we talked about the project, we talked about this type of a construction, where we were going to do it and how we were going to do it. And there was all kinds of support coming out of city council. And we did go through the permitting application process. In fact, when you talk about a project governed by NTIA, you're darn right I had to follow procedures, especially with granted money from the federal government. We never would have put fiber on poles in any city or county in this state without approval. If we're a nonprofit agency, that would look horrible.
Are you the ones that ran the wire to SCZ? Or was that, no, that was you, okay. Okay.
Okay, is there any further questions or comment?
No.
Swarm? Okay. What we have is no one, Nat is asking for a variance to put overhead cable for approximately 5 blocks.
Approximately.
And this would be running in the alley between, I believe it's Pine Street and Main Street.
I'm sorry, can I ask one more question?
Yes.
This is for the benefit of one customer, correct?
Well, correct. That pointed question is for Washington State Department of Agriculture. Of course, once you have 5 to 6 blocks of infrastructure, everybody on that route then has an opportunity for low-cost broadband because the construction costs have already been taken care of.
The USBR, the Columbia Basin Irrigation District, all those guys are ready to go as soon as this happens.
And that's
so they're, you know, in that government building that we have right here, there's like 4 or 5 different entities that occupy that building. The Water Master's Office for the Bureau of Reclamation, the East Columbia Basin Irrigation District.
They're further down. This is just going up
to... The Water Master's Office is in the...
Just going up to... What's the government office you're going to?
Washington State Department of Agriculture.
And isn't that in the building right there next to Lepicon?
It's in the same office building as the accounting firm.
Yeah, the Water Master, they're all down 17 Main.
They're in, but the line would be running down 7th Street, I believe, a little ways. Then it would catch the alley behind the Bureau of Reclamation office and the Irrigation District office, and then run eastward till it hit the...
Yeah, but this is how the business of telecommunications works. You know, a few customers are able to procure fiber optic service, a service that is then built 1 mile, half a mile, a quarter mile, and then all the small to medium businesses, all the public agencies on that route then have the potential to benefit from something else that was already capitalized. It's really a good thing, and it works really well.
If you look at the map, it goes right down.
That's what I thought that was coming off 14. Is this coming off 14th or 7th?
7th.
7th,
okay.
And then crossing over and it's going straight up the alley.
Now, if you had to bore it, it would come off from the connection east, and actually you would come down.
Well, if we had to bore it.
If you had to bore it, it's completely different, yeah. And it's a completely different direction you're coming from, too.
Yeah, once we drill it, it is definitely just for the one customer.
Yes. Okay.
All right. So you were in the process of stating the motion?
Yes, we need a motion to for a variance for NOAA-NET.
I'll make that motion, provided that the requirements are met.
I assure you.
All right. Second.
First, second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion so carried.
Thank you.
Okay, 4.3. Noel Communications, lat irrigation variance.
Hi, my name is Diane Bennett. I'm the Director of Sales and Marketing for Noel Communications. We're a private company based out of Yakima, Washington. This is Joshua Silius. He's our Senior Sales Manager. And we have Patrick Trotter with us, who's our outside plant guy in charge of building the fiber. I'm going to come at this as sort of a different sort of viewpoint. We were started in business 28 years ago as Northwest Microwave, and we just did licensed spectrum microwave point to point from city to city and then handed it off to another carrier to get to the customer. Probably 2000, we started getting into fiber and switching off of the microwave. And in 2007, we were contacted by the Adams County and asked if we could consider bringing fiber into the city of Othello. So it's something that we had never done before, and we met with city officials, we met with county officials. I remember standing out here on the streets and they were showing us you can go from this pole to this pole to this pole, and they even erected a pole so we could get into the city. You're on our internet here. We went through the franchise agreement, we've gone through city approval on every job. We never heard about this ruling that you had. So I'm thinking, since I don't know where we missed it, I think ignorance is, you know, bliss, but not really in legal territory. But since we were being guided by the city and the county, I think somebody should have maybe informed us. We are a small regional carrier. We're privately held. We would not have put this kind of hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in aerial fiber if we knew that it would have to be buried. We would be out. We can't afford to put that kind of money in. So now we're just a little bit stuck. We have an investment in fiber in the community. We serve hospitals, city government, state government, county government, schools, and with nowhere to go. So, I think I'm going to leave this to talk. Josh can talk about that particular deal that we have with LAD Irrigation. That was something that was started quite some time ago. They're going to be servicing another company who will go to residential market to provide an alternative for your citizens here. So with that, I think I'm just going to leave you to speak to it.
Perfect. So in January of this year, we entered into an agreement with Spectrum Online Services, which is an ISP mostly based in Grant County out of the Moses Lake area. And their goal with us building fiber in was they're actually the ones that are going to be serving LAD irrigation. We'll be giving them a bigger pipe so that hopefully they can apply with you guys and start doing residential internet and get some more competition in town, if you will. So not only does this fiber line serve just land irrigation. It is also a bigger pipe to the internet to connect residential, small, medium, large business via the wireless product. So I don't know if you guys have my variance by chance. Not really sure how to go about this. Basically, we've provided pictures that show the aerial construction that's already been completed with the permit that we have supplied for the little bit of underground that needs to be done. Yeah, go back. Oh, that's actually our footprint. Sorry, that's a different one. If not, I have copies that I can give. But basically, we've already constructed, as you know, we've constructed the aerial portion. It's sitting on the building, ready to go into the building and be terminated and connected to our backbone via that underground piece. Yeah, perfect. So go ahead and go to the next slide if you want. But basically, down in Industrial Lane, we've already constructed all of that. It's sitting on top, and we've applied the permit for underground to connect the back to our backbone. Because that's our backbone out of the world. So earlier today, I had sent off kind of some comments, I guess, to the memo agenda. And part of it in there was pricing. So instead of being the $10,000 that it is, I don't know, did you guys get a chance to read what I supplied earlier today? But basically, it, aerial, we can do everything aerial in-house. We have a crew with a bucket team that's able to go up and install that ourselves. Everything that we do underground is contracted out. Pat has a very same thing as Nonet. There's a range out there that they're going to say it's going to be this much per foot to go this distance. So as you can see, it is quite the difference. And for what little we charge in monthly, there's no way that it would ever pencil out. And I'm positive that the client's not going to flip that extra $60,000. So at this time, I'd like to answer any questions or...
Yep. First of all, I have a very blunt question for you. I don't want you to take this as being rude because I don't intend to be rude. But you guys have done several things that's not basically above board. You're doing things without permits. You came in around 1,300 or 1,400 feet of wire back in July when you knew that code existed. So basically, what I want to know, the wire that you did put up, if we allow that to go on and give you the variance, how are we supposed to know that the wire you put up is put up correctly and not went around things as we did without permits?
I promise we can provide those exact same...
That wire was put up, right? Submitted, so...
Come stand up here.
Yes, please.
So...
State your name.
Patrick.
For the record.
Patrick Crowder.
So, I put up the wire before July, and it was my fault, and I take the blame for not working with the city and the $40 right-of-way fee. And I did it on a Vista's approval that we went through for...
Okay, but when you guys put that up, you knew that code existed, and you went around and you did it anyway. That's where I'm coming from. You knew the ordinance existed.
That was before. It was before July.
We found out.
And then when I submitted the permit to the city for the other to Terry,
they got some background information here. Looks like they did the work in this day.
Okay, according to Terry, according to our public works, it wasn't. That's not true.
Well, they completed the aerial construction in May, according. Now, is that a true statement of fact?
Yeah.
On your background context that you've provided to the city, you're stating that you received pole attachment approval from Avista and completed the aerial construction in May of 2015.
Correct.
Okay. But then you learned about this situation that we have
which is a city ordinance that's on the books, that in the workshop of 7/6/15?
We learned about it whenever we applied for the underground portion. That's when.
That's when it came to your attention.
Everything was going to be put on hold, and we had to come to the fair.
Regardless of knowing that ordinance was there or not, you've been doing this long enough, you know, you still can go in and use somebody's right of way. You still have to wait to get a permit.
Correct?
Correct. Okay, but did you guys come get the permit? Did you apply for the permit at all?
No, we did not.
Okay, so you went around the permit process.
Correct.
To make one comment on that, up until this year, we have hired out all of our construction to Blue Mountain, and yes, we made a mistake. Pat was new. It was just starting heading up our outside plant. So I'll admit we did make a mistake. It's not something that we're happy about either, and not something that we'd like to be known by.
But there's been some other issues too. Like when the wire was ran to SBC, there was a crew came in on a weekend and ran an overhead wire. It was all directional for underground until you got down to Broadway first. And you came in on a weekend and then you ran it above ground.
I don't know about it being, so we actually went back and looked at that, and between Jim Schuler, our director of operations, and Terry, we provided the full blueprints that showed that pole that we planned on building. And I can provide that proof.
But anyway,
we had to do that to go over there's a spur of a railroad track there.
So anyway, that's what I want to know is how am I to get my vote supposed to know that everything was done above board the way it's supposed to be? So in 5 years, that line's not drooping 10 feet, you know, so it's 10 feet off the ground. We have lots of wires around town that are drooping bad. When I drive my truck through the alley, I can look straight out my window, which is about 8 feet, and I'm looking straight at wires.
Our system is much different than the ones that you're seeing all these. We actually sent the crew out to get a picture of every attachment.
But attachments break. We have ice storms that come in and they break attachments. They break off poles. The wires fall down. How do we know that they're going to get fixed?
So we only have one bundle of wire that's kind of the main, and then the drops. If any one of those gets broke or dropped or whatever, immediately we lose services. So we'll have staff out there fixing that immediately. I mean, it's because it would take out service. And there's no way for it to. We don't have any drops that get cut or disconnected and just cut and hang. It's a different fiber system that we have, I guess.
But what I'm saying too is, like you told me yourself at that meeting we had here a month ago or so ago, that you've already got wires moving. You've got them hanging. They start out at 16 feet. It's down to 15 feet already, and it's been a year. You know, so is that wire going
to... That wire was actually from 2007, and...
Okay, 8 years.
So, and I think the one case that you're talking about, we had attached a case actually to come into this building. It's right out there. To come into this building that added some weight to it. It is drooping, but it's still... I mean, I don't know if you guys went back and fixed that one yet or not, but it's... I mean, it is our job to
see,
be in compliance.
That's the issue I have. I don't know if this has been done or not, you know?
With what's been going on since I learned about this in July, I've done a pretty rigorous inspection, and I have fixed a couple issues, but I have three spots out my lad. There's coils in the pole, and I have one more spot that a case is completely demolished and we coil it up. But ever since this came up, believe me, I've gone through town and I've looked at everything very much. I'm on the line here that I messed up with the one permit my first time in hell. I've worked in Seattle, Redmond, everything. It was my fault. And going forward, obviously, as far as it has come, more is not going to happen again, right? Warranted. I understand your point, and a lot of other cities around in Washington have started going this way, but they've done it in smart ways, as when their pole line has met its life expectancy on their pole studies, that at that time, all the lines, everyone on the lines, it will go underground and everyone will have a shared cost. Mm-hmm. From the top down, everyone.
And that's basically what our ordinance says. It says no new wires. All new wires and cable go underground.
Correct. With the variance is why we're here. So I agree with all your new wires underground, but there is a variance to the law that says if the poles aren't going to be bad in 5 years, or, you know, if it makes sense, it's okay.
That's not what it says.
But what are we doing?
Do you use mainly Avista poles for all your wiring?
In the city of Bethel, yes. Some Big Bend, they're kind of scattered. But yes, these in that are all Avista. And
Avista, you got them on your email list. If you've been going around looking at all these problems, if you see a problem, they're notified right away of corrections that are needed.
Is that going to be kept up on a constant, consistent inspection?
Yes. Ian and the local office have to make sure that if they see anything, they'll get that out to the building inspectors.
And what I heard from Avista tonight, great strides have been met. A lot of actions have been taken since this was brought up in a council meeting a few months ago. And I'm really happy how fast that has occurred. And great, it meant, sounds like, with a committee to help address this issue quite a bit.
Avista jumped on their stuff pretty quick.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a pole in my backyard for 3 years that I've been trying to get removed, and a month after they got it removed last week, so I was pretty happy about that.
And Noel, you're going to be responsible to Avista since you are using their right-of-ways too, also.
100%.
So we've got to answer to them also.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Is there any further questions or comments? I think we've...
You guys service the schools in town?
Correct. So we do it two different ways. We actually, the new building that they have out on 26 or 24, we build fiber into there to connect back to Juniper. And then we also serve a company called Ednetics, which brings services into the school district. A very large bandwidth.
How about like Wahidas School? You're doing that one there? That's on 14th?
We are not doing that one. They have their own fiber system that they've done a lot. It just happened that the one over on 24 was far enough away from their plant that it was easier to come to us for those services. Yeah, so we,
You just did the new West Farm up there?
Yes.
Is that's underground?
Correct.
Well, I just want one question answered, Travis, if you can come up to the mic. In your recommendation for the variance, the motion that you've made for us to vote on, you state that without some demonstration that Noel Communications is willing to repair its relationship with the city and remedy some or all of the existing violations, the city should think twice before rewarding the behavior with the right to place more overhead infrastructure in the city. So where do we get that assurance from? How do we get that assurance? Like Corey's asking right now today, are you going to work with Avista? And are you going to clean up what needs to be cleaned up and work in the future to make sure you do it all right?
Yes, you have my assurance that we will.
Absolutely. So Travis, does that satisfy you, or do you need something in writing to satisfy you?
That is, I think that's one of the things that I punted to the council, because to me that's a policy decision. I was looking at it strictly from a...
Well, I'm asking you, how do we handle it? How do we handle getting the assurance from a company that's going to be working within the city that we're requesting them to follow guidelines. And you're making a person, you're making a recommendation for us.
I think the fact that they are all working together and making a concerted effort to coordinate what they're doing is a huge step that I could not have pointed to when I started this process. You know, there's that aspect of ensuring that they're policing each other, which is the best option for me because as staff for the city's not responsible for doing that. So that's a great way to do it. The other half of that statement is kind of the question of who does the service actually benefit? And of course, in this case, Lad Irrigation is a member of the community, but
yeah, but as it says in this recommendation, this motion, you know, for the motion, that any future residencies that would continue down Concrete Drive would benefit from the service of the fiber optics that are available from Lad moving forward.
Yes, I'm sorry, I see what you're saying. Yes, so theoretically, like, one of the things that they responded to the staff report, if you looked at the most recent version, because one of the comments I raised in that is if and when it does get put underground, that would be bunched into a larger project and Lad would be asked to only pay for a small portion of that undergrounding cost. So theoretically, it would be spread out over others.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that they are now aware of, you know, when they can and can't do the undergrounding, you know, they'll be more cognizant of that in the future. Whether or not they can apply for many more variances before they, you know, three strikes they're out and they have to start undergrounding, that, you know, theoretically, now that they know that they need to come to the council with justification.
Well, you're strongly recommending denial. You know, you are the one that wrote this.
Yep.
And you're strongly recommending denial of the request. Requested variance because the work's required to be underground. But convince me.
Okay. So I guess the one question that we would need to ask Lad, and that is, or I'm sorry, that we would need to ask Norwood Communication, and that is, if this project were to come down to a rebuild of the road, and they were called and said, you needed to underground your utilities at this point. We have our trench open and it'll be open for the next 4 days. If they come down and lay the line, then Noel is assuming that cost to do it, as opposed to if our contractor is placing conduit in the ground, somebody else is paying for it, then Noel only needs to come put it through somebody else's conduit. So those are one of the questions about how are we going to ensure that those costs aren't being passed on in the future. But I'm sorry, I don't know the utility business well enough to know whether Lad pays for that undergrounding when the trench is open or whether that's something that's paid for by the developer and gets reimbursed by whoever's using the conduit that they, the empty conduit that they put in the ground.
Hey, Council, sorry to interrupt, but one piece of information that I would just put to council for consideration. Under our variance, the Thelen Municipal Code 14.56.050, when granting a variance, the city council may attach conditions to the granting of the variance. Now, what I hear the council asking staff is, what kind of assurances do we have that they're going to comply in the future? We're not going to run into the situation where they've done things without asking for permission first, and we're back here, they're asking for another variance. Yeah, one thing that we don't have to close the record tonight, we can keep it open. One thing you may consider is having staff come back with recommendations of conditions on the variance that would provide the assurances that the city council is looking for, such that if the conditions were violated, the variance would no longer be in force in effect. That's just something I put to the council's consideration. You'd have to, I think, to do that proper though, you'd have to leave the record open on this public hearing and not close it tonight, and we could revisit it in 2 weeks' time or however long staff needs to do that. That is, if you're looking for assurances, that is one avenue that the council could could contemplate.
So any of our aerial in this entire state, if it ever goes underground in a joint use, relocate underground, we're going to be there the same here in Olympia, or here in Othello, as we would be in Olympia or Everett, or anywhere for that matter. If you guys are doing a street project on Industrial Lane and it goes underground, we would be here just the same. It's the communication thing with the Vista and everybody else in this entire room, that we're all in it together and we work together. The cost of the underground, we pay for all the pipe. It usually gets tacked into a trench fee for the amount of the distance of the trench that was dug for the joint trench. It all gets divvied out. It's the same in Olympia. We did a roundabout project. Our portion was small. Cable TV had all these drops. They had a lot more trenching. There's a percentage of that project that goes in to underground and facilities. And it's the same across the state. And then we do the same here in Othello. I mean, it's a standard practice. It's a forced relocate. It's underground LID. It's what you do when you have utility companies. So I guess the answer to your question would be yes. Absolutely.
Okay.
I just want to make one more statement. I don't. That's an industrial area down there. I don't believe that area down there will be ever anything but an industrial area. So I don't have a problem with putting a line up. I just want to make sure that the wires don't end up like they are up here in town in residential areas.
Correct.
They're terrible. Absolutely terrible. And you drive down the alleys, there's rat nests all over. There's drooping wires. It's just terrible, and I don't want to see, just because it's an industrial area, the aesthetics workmanship down there needs to stay the same as it would in a residential area. And you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So,
I mean, it's a very clean system down there.
Yeah, and that's why I'd like to see it stay that way.
We are the only ones on the board, other than Vista. It's a very clean area. I do understand. I have driven down alleys and I've seen things, so I agree.
Okay, wait.
Yeah, one other input, and this is not just for you all, but it's for Vista and knowing that as well, and anybody else who's going to hang on our poles. One of the things in our meeting we had with you all, and one of the things the council members have requested, was, you know, not a plan to not do this again, but also a plan to help, you know, slowly throughout the city put things underground, starting perhaps with parks. I haven't heard mention of that or a plan for doing that yet, and I thought we were going to talk about that, even though that's sort of out there. But it's still something I would like to hear from you all, that I understand the need for the Wi-Fi and the need for everything else, but I believe council wanted, you know, a plan to eventually get the stuff, especially around some, you know, park areas and residential areas in the city, to start putting it underground. So I would say that, you know, not speaking for council, but, you know, before we come back with another variance, I realize the need to get LAD done, the need to get the agriculture department done. I understand that piece had been hanging on for a while. But council, I would suggest that you ask, you know, for that before you come forward with another variance to go above ground again, to have a plan as we spread out. And that's up to you all. And of course, the city's going to work with you on that. But
I just got a comment. We just did a job up in La Crosse. We put in water line, and the telephone company up there, Pioneer Telephone, they had us dig our trench extra wide, and we put the conduit in for them, and then they, you know, did all the boxes and all that. So we did that for them, so they wouldn't have to go underground, dig their own trench. We're already doing it through the whole town. We did that. And then like the new Olson homes up there, everything's underground up there. I'm just kind of surprised that no fiber or anything has gone into those areas. But yeah.
Okay. So what we got right now, and this is up to the council, whether you want to go on with this variance to supply the fiber to lat irrigation, or wait till next meeting to get some of the assurances that...
Well, I would like to, personally, my opinion, like you guys to work with Travis and give him some sort of assurance so that he doesn't, I mean, because right now his recommendation is denial. And if you're going to convince somebody, convince him, so that he can come back to us with something that says something other than denial at this point. So I'd like to table this until you've had an opportunity to talk to Travis and the staff and get their buy-in, so that when they come back to us for a motion to for a variance, I'm satisfied that they're satisfied with you and with what you're going to do moving forward.
Would that work with Noel Communications?
That's my recommendation.
For the next meeting?
Yeah, we'll do what...
Meet with Travis? Okay, we need a motion on that. Further...
Well, I think the way to fashion that is to end the discussion tonight, but leave the public, leave the record open for the public hearing, and we would conclude it at the next council meeting after you've gotten additional information from Noel and from Travis. Okay. And then you can close the public record at that time, and then council can make its decision based on the entire public record.
Okay, great. So, for tonight, we will continue this discussion at our next council meeting, which would be... You got the date, Debbie?
The 26th.
26th of October.
What I would suggest is entertain a motion to continue the public hearing to the 26th.
Okay.
Do I have that motion?
Got a motion. First and second. All in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. You know who you got to meet with? Okay, and we'll see you back at the next meeting.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Again, Paul Kimmel again from Avista. Just to follow up with Wade, we certainly do intend to continue the conversation, meet with staff, and figure out kind of a long-range plan, how we're addressing undergrounding going forward, work with you. I mean, we'll probably sit down with a lot of our joint users as well, and your staff, and figure out, okay, what are your priority needs for undergrounding? How can we get there and sort of start addressing it? So absolutely. We just wanted to demonstrate some forward progress tonight, obviously. But again, this is just the first step. So thank you.
Okay, we'll go on to 4.4. Appointment of David Anderson and Connie Higginbroth to the Independent Salary Commission. Let me bring this up here. We have two commissioners on the Independent Salary Commission that have resigned, Larry McCourty and Leonard Lyon. David and Connie have both agreed to be appointed to fill the unexpired terms. This appointment is being made by the mayor with confirmation of the council. So we need a motion to approve the appointment of these two to the Independent Salary Commission.
I will make that motion.
Second. First and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Any opposed? So it's so carried. 4.5, sewer rate ordinance. Spencer.
Thank you very much. At our last meeting, we discussed the sewer rates, and at that meeting, I was instructed to prepare an ordinance with a 10% increase in that with those to the sewer rates for review at tonight's meeting. There was also some other discussion that was wanted at that meeting to see what would different rate increases of different types of services look like when we're trying to save up for our new water our new sewer treatment plant, our new facility. I prepared an Excel document, or what we're doing right now will allow us to keep on building our reserves for our new sewer treatment plant. I prepared a document that looked at our industrial rates independently from our residential, schools, commercial, so we can see what would our transfer to reserves look like if we just did a larger increase to the industrial. And let me bring up that, I brought up that Excel spreadsheet. Let me walk you through that just for a second. So right now we have a 10% increase. This column right here shows a 10% increase to our sewer rates, and that would allow us to put approximately $990,000 into our reserve. And again, the purpose of this reserve is to save up for our $25 to $30 million sewer treatment plant that the Department of Ecology is going to want sometime in our future. So that's with the 10% increase across the board. I built a spreadsheet here that would show what would happen if we change that 10% increase. For example, we have some separate family residents. They represent about 82% of the total revenue up here. So if we decrease the residential down to 5%, you can see that up here our the estimated dollar figure that we'd be able to put in reserve goes down quite a bit. So it's $958,000 from, what was it before, $10,000. So it's about $40,000, that decrease would have on our overall ability to put money away in our sewer reserves. Down towards the bottom, I'm leaving both of these up here, up towards the top, so you can see when we're playing around with this, what that effect has compared to the standard 10%. So if we come down to our industrial rates right here, right now it's 10%. I'm going to put 10% across the board and see what that looks like. So we have 10%. So that gets us to our 10% across the board. We have $990,000. If we go down to our industrial rates, and if we raise those 20%, for example, 20% for those, the industrial users represent a little under 1% of the total revenue brought into that fund. So they're really quite a small piece. If I double the 10% to the 20%, see what effect that has. That has a $600 effect on our, that's the total difference up here. We can do a 40%, but because we're talking about it, it's about a 0.7% piece of the pie of industrial. If we do a 40% increase, what does that look like? Just a little under $2,000 there. I'm gonna come back and move that to 10%. If we, like I did before, the residential is the largest piece of that pie, about 82%. If I move that to 13%, just change it 3% from where we were, you can see that has a huge effect on the difference up here. Or if I move it down to 7%, move it down 3%, that's a $23,000 difference between the two options, the standard 10% and the variable rate, I was calling it.
So it was kind of interesting looking at the rates like this. We can raise some of them, we can lower some of them. Ultimately, I think what we would all agree on is we need to increase our reserve account to be able to fund this new sewer treatment plant that's coming down in the future. When we have rates that are competitive compared to other rates in the city or other rates in the state, that's a positive for being able to grab grant money and secure low interest loans. The more money we're able to put down against this facility off the bat, right off the bat, it just means that we'd have to get a lower dollar amount in loans. This is an expense that's coming down the pike none of us like it. I was going to say if we like it or not, but I don't think any of us like it. But by doing a smaller 10% increase across the board as opposed to a 50% increase or some type of larger increase down the road, I think this would be a more conservative. It's the baby steps towards that goal that we're looking at. With that, is there any other discussion that you wanted to have as council, or do we want to consider that ordinance?
Did you happen to get a chance to see what Warden was paying before they put in their new plan?
No. And this is coming faster than we think. I heard that the governor just had a long conversation with the DOE saying that he feels that they're falling behind and that they really need to tighten up on their regulations and so forth. So I think that this treatment plant may come faster than we're thinking.
I actually have a question. I don't know if you'd be able to answer me. Yeah. Can. The industrial is only paying 1% towards that 990.
Yeah.
How much of our treatment plant is the industrial actually using? Do you know?
Yeah. Right now, it's very little. Maybe I should ask Terry about that. I believe a lot of the wastewater from those facilities go out towards Bruce or go somewhere else. The way the rates are structured for a commercial, let's look at just commercial. We have a base monthly rate, and then they pay per the water usage. With industrial, it's not based on water usage. It's based on employees. So there's the base rate, and then another.
So we get that extra surcharge.
Dollar something per employee per month. Yeah.
So it's very, very little of the total.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
You know, we started this process back in 2010, I believe, ramping up our rates. And we knew back then we were going to need the sewer. And I think we're good for at least another 5 years. I mean, the permitting processing's come out. So we bought another 5 years. That's from 2010. That's more time than what I thought we originally had. I thought we'd already be in the planning process of that facility right now and what we need in construction here in a couple of years. But we did buy a little more time with it. But that just gives us more time to build up our reserve for this. And that's not much less that we're going to have to borrow. And that's that much less that we're going to have to burden the public with trying to have to repay all at one time and operate this facility. And I think what we set up then is working really great right now to build up to the future, and I think we need to continue it. That's my personal opinion of it.
Probably another 5 years also will probably be putting the $35 million instead of 25 to 30 million.
Yes. And then we'd be looking at different options, what we could possibly do with that plant. We were discussing at our ACDC meeting the other night, the Port District is looking at an industrial waste plant. plant possibly. And that's something that we could possibly look at with this plant too, because we do have possibilities of industrial waste. And when we get those on, they're going to be our bigger contributors to this facility too, possibly. And that's where we could go to them and ask to help pay this facility. So that's something that we're going to have to look at in the future, what this, what we want this plant to do for us. But I think we're on the right track right now, and I think we need to continue it.
I just had a quick question for Terry. Is there any land out there to build this on, or is it all just ponds?
It's all ponds. Everything past the sewer plant right now is all there.
So how would we build this treatment plant if... Because we can't take the ponds out to build the treatment plant.
Sure you can. You fill one pond in and start building your plant. And then once you get a portion of it done, you fill in another pond. You know, you're not going to need the ponds. You're not going to need them.
And quite honestly, what we'd have to do first is like the port's doing, is get a feasibility study that would tell us how we do that. That may be one plan. Maybe they'd say you have to acquire some land, whatever. But that's what we wouldn't just go in and say, okay, let's start building. We'd spend some money, get the grants like the ports done.
Port district has, yeah.
Getting some grants to get a feasibility study and then go from there.
Okay.
Just one question.
Yeah.
Do you, Terry, could you figure out how much volume is traveling down that sewer line from the industrial area on North Broadway?
We don't take industrial waste.
I know.
I don't know how much flow you take it down there. When you get up there around 6 o'clock, you don't have a bunch at all. There's very little.
Really?
Yes, very little. You've got coming out of your pipe there.
Basically, that's just from the restrooms and the facilities, any kitchen type facility, yes.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but we've got hand washing stations and sinks and things like that. I mean, we use a heck of a lot of city water, and it all goes back into the city sewer system. And, I mean, it's a lot of water. So I was just wondering if there's any way to tell. It's not industrial wastewater. It's just sanitary service. I mean, it's 10 million gallons a month.
Okay. So do we have a motion tonight to continue with the sewer rate increase of 10%.
I'll make that motion.
We have a motion made. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
We got a second. All in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? So carried. Thank you. Okay, on to unfinished business. Is there any unfinished business to bring up in front of the council tonight? New business, meeting time and change. The next council meeting, the 26th, we're going to try to set it up for primarily the budget. We would like to start at 6 p.m. and dinner will be served here. Yes. We will have a round table set up for reviewing all the budget on the 26th.
Okay, that's what we just told them.
So are we gonna before the budget?
We could put them on the agenda first. Yeah. We'll take care of it really quick. I think by then we'll have a lot of our questions answered by then. And
hopefully
we've got one person to satisfy out there, I think.
Can we let them know it's going to be 6 instead of 7?
To make sure that they know.
Okay. Any other questions or comments for the change of the next council meeting? Okay. Now we would like to go into executive session. This will now adjourn. This meeting will now adjourn to executive session. To go into executive session pursuant to RCW 42.30.10.110 to review the performance of a public employee. The executive session is expected to last 15 minutes. No action will be taken during the executive session. Personnel that you would like to stay? The attorney? Everybody else could be excused. Make it clear the chambers this meeting out of executive session. No action will be taken. And any further business for the council? The meeting's adjourned.